I mean, just a little bit of breeze. And then when it got to maximum Q, it would be oscillating only 7 degrees. It would be kind of a wild ride, but it's nothing. So anyway, what Mike had to do was just coarsely line it up, and then he could have ate his lunch during reentry, and it would straighten itself out.
Like any good airplane.
Now, that's really true. It was a carefree reentry, and I think that that's the most brilliant thing Bert ever thought of. The other thing was that we didn't get overheated because Bert figured out that the atmosphere at 110,000 feet is less than 1% of sea level, and there is not enough air to conduct the heat out of the very hot air that was sitting around the airplane. It couldn't conduct into the structure in the short time that we were in that period. Yeah. And that was Bert's idea, and a lot of guys didn't believe that would happen. But I've always trusted Bert, and I believed he was right, and he was. It worked perfectly.
If you take a very large bunch of molecules and slow them to the nose of the airplane, or slow them down by 3.5 Mach numbers, you'll heat them up by about 1,100 to 1,200 degrees, okay? But where we re-entered, those molecules still go to 1,100 or 1,200 degrees, but there's so few of them that they don't heat the structure very much. Spaceship One really only needed 4 pounds of thermal protection. We flew with 14.
Amazing, amazing. We are rapidly running out of time this evening.
No?
Okay. But where do you see the future going with aviation? What is your vision for what the future holds?
You're going to have to ask Doug. I'm retired.
Me too. I'm also retired.
I can't say.
So the question that people have asked me to ask you is, you're not really retiring, are you?
Well, let me jump back 30 seconds and point out, when everybody asks me what's next, the best thing for me to do is to remind them of when they saw a starship from us, when they saw a Triumph, when they saw a spaceship. They saw these things after they were done and ready to fly. And why would I just all of a sudden change my mind and show them something that hasn't flown yet or is nowhere near ready to fly? There's a good reason to not share what you're going to do. There's very good reasons, safety reasons and competition reasons and so on. You'll get a lot of help redesigning it if you tell the world what you're going to do. Once we unveiled Spaceship One in April of 2003, we had a bunch of real experts telling us that the feather would not work. But I didn't want them to tell me that before I built it. But anyway, if somebody says, well, you've got to tell me what's next, you just remind them that we'll look back at what you've seen. We never told you what's next.
Listening to EAA Radio, 93.3 FM, 1210 AM, and online at eaaradio.net.
EAA Radio thanks Moseley Broadcast for their support. Moseley Broadcast designs and manufactures wireless communications equipment for the radio and television broadcast industries. Moseley products are in service in over 100 countries and are actively represented in 60 countries nationwide. Find out more at MoseleySB.com.
The moon is out, so are the mosquitoes. It must be summer in Wisconsin. Welcome back to Theater in the Woods on EAA Radio.
Well, keep in mind, since 1972, I've had very wonderful, vivid memories of introducing a brand new airplane, and a lot of them had not been seen before they were unveiled here. And enjoying watching a large crowd look at something new. And we've done that since 72, when I brought the very big in here first. What was different for me this year is that a long time ago, I hangared the Catbird to take the engine and nose gear to build my twin, the Boomerang. That was done in the late 80s. It might have been as late as 93 or so, 93, 94. And that airplane, since then, has been essentially a display model hanging upside down in the flight test hangar of Scale Composites. The Boomerang, I kept flying it some. I brought it to Oshkosh 3 times after I lost my medical. You know, I would get someone who could act as pilot in command, and you know, I'd put him in a seat without rudder pedals, but I did find that...
That's the word, act.
I found something that was a real weird discovery. If you'd taken any airplane, almost, and taxi it above the stall speed and pull the stick back, it'll fly without a medical. And when Doug says knock it off, I think the main reason that I stopped flying the Boomerang, even though it was a nuisance to have to find someone to go anywhere, its most recent flight was a golf trip with Brian Binney, is that I was working very, very hard on Spaceship One in 2002 when I last flew it. So I was about ready to retire. I couldn't take airplanes to Idaho where I was moving. I didn't have a medical, and with a defibrillator, I probably can't get a medical. All of a sudden, in front of me was a big dilemma. What do I do with my airplanes? And something really struck me, and that is the Catbird and the Boomerang were examples of airplanes that had excellent performance and efficiency and range. The other airplanes that are out there with the Rutan design name on them are moderate performance airplanes, you know, like the Long Easies and Defiance and so on. And that really bugged me that I actually made a decision at once that we would fix up the Boomerang just enough for a ferry flight to Oshkosh. We'd give it to the museum, let them hang it up with the gear up, and I would take out the nose gear and the engine on the right, bring it back and give it to Zach, who wanted to fly the Catbird, and let him use that engine and nose gear, which is where they came from, and let him get the Catbird flying. That was my plan. We pulled the Boomerang out of the hangar, washed it, and I went out and started the engines. And even that old 93 Mac laptop booted up and gave me engine data. And I just thought, I can't put this airplane down. It's the only twin out there that you can fly at min control speed, fly at minimum speed, engine out, without using the rudder pedals. And that to me was a significant accomplishment, a dramatic difference than any other twin. And I said, I can't put down the only airplane that has these capabilities. I just can't do it. And Trace Clements came forward and says, I want to restore it and I want to operate it. And I said, yes. So now I had a dilemma. I had to buy an engine for Zach for the Catbird. And I did. And he scrounged up a nose gear off an old Duchess that we had parted out. And those two guys worked very hard for 2 or 3 months at least. And those airplanes never flew in the same year. And they sent me a picture of them in formation flying over the field. And it just caught me really hard for 2 reasons. One, here they're flying together, they never had. And 2, I had never seen, and I saw this while I was still working there, I'd never seen the Boomerang fly because I was always in it. And Mike and Trace went out and flew the Boomerang, and for the first time, I watched it take off and make this beautiful pass over the field, and it really struck me as being, this is something I've never seen before, and I'd never seen the Boomerang fly. So anyway, to me, it was a very emotional thing to see those airplanes restored, modern instrumentation, and to have them flown to Oshkosh. And I want to continue to have them flown and let people enjoy them.
And some questions from the audience here.
Just one. After that incredible flight around the world in the Voyager and landing back at Edwards, did he get a chance to figure out how much fuel was left in the tanks?
Yep. Yeah, Bruce Evans and I drained the fuel out of 17 fuel tanks. 17 separate fuel tanks, we got 18.4 gallons. And, you know, that's not much fuel in each tank.
It was enough to fly to Seattle.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let me point out that we leaked that much fuel due to a very tiny leak over many days in the right wing fuel cap. The fuel cap was a quarter inch nylon plug, and it had a little leak and had a little stain. And over 9 days, we lost the same amount of fuel as what we had when we landed.
Got another question back here on your left.
Mike, I wonder if you could share the story about the time you were the backup pilot on the RPV and one of the systems failed and you landed out in the desert around Edwards or something.
Yeah, this was the Quiver?
Yeah,
the Quiver was a RPV or a UAV in modern terms. And we didn't think that it was a good idea to take an autopilot that we had designed and built ourselves and an airplane that we had designed and built, or Bert had designed and built, without having a pilot able to fix it if something went wrong. So Bert came up with the idea of putting a saddle on the top of the plane, and Doug and I ended up being the guys that had to sit in that saddle. And that was really an uncomfortable experience. You're sitting behind a Rotax engine that's making 100 miles an hour wind right into your face. And so the guys were trying to learn how to control this thing with the autopilot. And we would rescue it if they screwed it up by grabbing the stick. We had a little stick that moved one aileron and one elevator.
Yeah, we had a push-pull tube that would move one aileron.
Right, and one elevator.
And one elevator, yeah.
But we didn't have the stick, and we had no rudder pedals.
Fly-by-wire
rudder. A bit awkward. And we had stirrups, but they didn't function as rudder pedals. And the rudder was a twist grip on the top of the stick, which used the sensor, the servos that were driven by the radio control, the autopilot. And so something went wrong within that system, and both rudders went over to the left or the right, I forget which it was. And I thought the guy flying the airplane at that time, which was Dave Ganser, was just fooling with me, you know, trying to scare me. And I was sitting on the plane, and he really succeeded when he suddenly came on the radio and said, "Mike, I've lost it, you got it." So I turned off the autopilot and tried to fly it with the manual controls, and having no rudder, I couldn't fix the problem. So the airplane flew in a very weird, you know, right wing down slip, forward slip. I couldn't gain any altitude at full throttle because of the drag, and I could not line up with a runway at Mojave. So we made the decision to fly all the way to the dry lake, which was, 15 miles south. And so I started heading towards that dry lake, and I had a parachute on. But I was only like 300 or 400 feet above the ground. And I thought, man, I try to jump off this thing with a parachute, I'm not going to get there. So I stayed with the airplane and flew it to the dry lake. And the airplane had enormous adverse yaw due to the aileron drag on one side. And Dave Ganser had, the last words I heard from him was, "Remember the adverse yaw, Mike." And I thought about that all the way, thinking, wonder what the hell he's talking about. And then it occurred to me, you know, here I'm in this big slip. If I land, the wingtip's going to hit first. And you know that's not going to be a good landing. So I got there within, I could see the shadow on the dry lake of the wingtip. And they were only about 2 feet apart, the shadow and the wingtip. And I thought, man, if I put it down like this, I'm done. I'm sitting on the top of it. If it goes over, you know, it's going to be bad. So I just pulled the stick as hard as I could in the other direction. And the adverse yaw leveled the airplane, straightened it just for a second. I put it on the ground and stopped. And nothing happened to the airplane or to me. And I think Dave Ganza saved my life that day, and he's a good friend of mine. And then Doug and all those guys showed up and figured out that it was just a circuit breaker that had popped, right? And so they pushed it back in and said, well, you need to fly it back home now. And, you know, I didn't really feel like doing that. I mean, I was scared to death. I had just, like, miraculously survived an awful experience. But I got back on it, and I taxied around a little bit trying to get my courage up, and it took off. It seemed to fly all right, and I flew back to Mojave. Now, everybody had left to come to the dry lake, and when I got back, I think Sally and Bob Williams were the only people that scaled. They opened the door and helped us push it in the hangar, and we landed with, I think, the biggest crosswind we had ever flown in on that day. And, you know, that was an adventurous airplane.
I hope there's no one here from the Air Force, because right. Edwards Air Force Base got right. invaded from the north. Right. An airplane crashed on the lake bed within the Air Force Base territory, and we got the hell out of there, and they never knew we were there.
They never knew. Yeah. So much for their security. They never were aware that we had landed on their dry lake and left. But
they did find out later.
Yeah, of course.